Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, December 27, 2017. South Sudan government spokesman says he's not afraid of threats from the international community.
And the fact that I'm sanctioned does not stop me from continuing to perform my functions and duties as the Minister of Information and the spokesman of the government. I'll continue to talk for the government and say whatever the government wants to be said, because after all, I've no much interest in going to America.
And a South Sudanese diplomat says the national dialogue has a long way to go.
I see an intersection. Revitalization aims at ending the conflict as soon as possible. The national dialogue also begins with wanting to end the conflicts. But we have to admit that national dialogue does not have the capacity to impose peace immediately.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's information minister says he will continue to defend the Kiir administration despite U.S. sanctions imposed on him. Michael Makuei says threats from the United Kingdom, Norway, and the U.S. will not intimidate him or prevent him from speaking publicly on behalf of the government of South Sudan. Makuei acknowledges that the sanctions have impacted his family living in the United States.
Even a warning does not mean that we accept a bad peace. It doesn't mean that we just give in because we are under threat, and as such we must accept whatever. That is not true. We don't agree with that. We are here, whether it is us or the rebels, we are here to negotiate good peace so that we don't go back to war. The agreement which is being revitalized now proved not to be implementable in terms of some of its provisions, and this is what led to the revitalization now. So we don't want to come up with another agreement that may lead to another. I don't know what term will they use this time for the review of the agreement. But we don't want to come up with such a document again. This is why we are trying to thresh out whatever areas of disagreement, and we avoid any areas that might have taken us that far. So, yes, it is these people, they have the right to say whatever they want, but this does not mean that we must agree because of the threats. No. We will agree because we need peace. We need a real and genuine peace, not because we are being driven into peace.
Honorable Michael Makuei, I don't want to go personal with you on this interview, but I just want to reflect back. The U.S. government, the Department of Treasury, put your name among those who were sanctioned, and the reasons being that you were making inflammatory statements from South Sudan that was deemed as obstructing the road to peace, and they also mentioned the issue of you making threats against the UN mission in the country. You are put in a position where you speak on behalf of the government, and any statement that comes from you might be interpreted as blocking the road to peace. Do you personally feel that this is a threat to you?
Well, the fact that I was sanctioned is the right of that person. That person has the right to decide. If they have given themselves the right to decide on others, then it is their right. I don't question that. But what I'm saying is this. Whatever I was doing and whatever I'm doing up to this moment, I'm doing it in my official capacity as the spokesman of the government. And whatever I say is not my personal opinion, it's not my personal position, but this is the position of the government. That is one. Number two, those who gave themselves the right to determine whether others are conforming or are giving inflammatory statements or whatever, that is their position. And the fact that I'm sanctioned does not stop me from continuing to perform my functions and duties as the Minister of Information and the spokesman of the government. I'll continue to talk for the government and say whatever the government wants to be said. So the fact that I'm sanctioned, I have no much to do with it because, after all, I've no much interest in going to America.
But you have your family in Texas.
Yes,
your children are there. Your wife is there. You will not be seeing them.
Yes.
Don't you feel a little bit uncomfortable about that?
Well, I will not feel uncomfortable because I'm in contact with them. That is one. If they want to come and see me, it is open for them to come. They come and see me. So there is no way I would insist on going to America. And if they have decided not to allow me to go and see them, not that only, but there are some people who are not even sanctioned, but they are being refused entry into America. So,
have you ever applied for a visa since they imposed the sanction? Did you apply for a visa?
Well, I'm not going to do anything in America, so I have not applied.
Let's talk about the situation in Juba. This will be my last question. Let's talk about the situation in Juba. My understanding is that the government has not paid its employees for 5 months. When are you going to pay employees?
We will pay. We will, according to the report of the Minister of Finance in the last meeting, is now paying them 2 months. After Christmas, we will pay them one. There will be a balance of 2 months, which will be November and December. Their salaries will be paid in January. This is what I know so far. And this is the report which was given to us by the Minister of Finance. Issues of economic situation are not only in South Sudan, but they are all over. You see, there are a lot of economic problems all over the world.
How about your embassies around the world? In Washington, the staff that work there, the local staff, the South Sudanese, they have not been paid for a year. I don't know the diplomats.
Well, I have no much knowledge about the foreign embassies, whether they are paid or not. But what I know is that the statement which was given by the Minister of Finance, I thought it is inclusive.
But you speak on behalf of the government. You must be knowledgeable about the situation of your foreign embassies.
I'm knowledgeable, and this is why I'm saying that this what is said by the Minister of Finance must be inclusive.
That's Michael Makuei, South Sudan's Information Minister and government spokesman, speaking with me in Addis Ababa last week at the African Union headquarters. The Democratic Republic of Congo is struggling to deal with an influx of suspected South Sudanese rebels. The Congolese army has arrested at least 9 men so far, but family members and local refugee leaders say the men are legitimate refugees and should be released. Jason Patenkin reports from the Congolese border town of Aba.
Since South Sudan's government captured a rebel base last week in the country's southwest, hundreds of refugees have poured into Democratic Republic of Congo. Some among them may be rebels, and the Congolese army, wary of conflict spilling into their nation, is arresting any suspected fighters. Refugees say innocent young men are being caught up in the crackdown. Grace Gaba, speaking from the border town of Aba, where some 30,000 refugees have taken shelter, says her brother, Joseph Moreau, was arrested by Congolese troops at a checkpoint last week and has been held ever since. She says, "Among us eight, only my brother was arrested. Maybe they think my brother is a soldier, but he is not a soldier. It is hard to say how many suspected rebels have been arrested so far." A Congolese government source not authorized to speak to media said 9 suspected rebels were in army custody as of last week. Local refugee leaders put the number at 17. Alexi Kabambi, who leads Congo's National Commission for Refugees in Aba, says those determined to be rebels are sent to a military base in the town of Dungu, where they may be extradited to South Sudan. Kabambi says even if rebels enter Congo unarmed and renounce their military allegiances, they cannot be granted refugee status. He says, once you've carried a weapon, you cannot be accorded refugee status as a civilian. Even if you're granted refugee status, if it is revealed you engaged in military activities in the past, your status can be revoked. Liwa Morris Taban, chairman of ABBA's South Sudanese refugee community, says anyone who enters Congo as a civilian should be allowed to register as a refugee, even if that person was previously a combatant.
If he's no more rebel or he's not even soldier, He's a normal civilian. He has the right to be together with the rest in the side.
Researcher Alan Boswell says South Sudanese government soldiers who enter Congo can usually be sent home. But dealing with rebel fighters who cross the border is trickier.
Some want to be demobilized and be settled as refugees, but others will later want to return back and fight. It is essentially not possible to distinguish between who is ready to quit fighting and who is only there to recoup, recover, and return to combat.
As South Sudan's war continues, Congo will continue to struggle with combatants on both sides of the border. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Aba, Democratic Republic of Congo.
There are reports of violations of the ceasefire agreement signed by the government of South Sudan and various stakeholders last week in Addis Ababa. SIN Bureau reports speeches made at the high-level revitalization forum could provide some lessons on what went wrong and how the various stakeholders can try to implement a true ceasefire.
For stakeholders trying to revive the 2015 peace agreement, moving forward means taking a look back at past mistakes.
In order to do that, one of the things we have to do when reviewing the axis is admit what went wrong. Was the axis about individuals, or was it about setting up systems that would promote the welfare of the South Sudanese people? If we are able to admit our past mistakes, that our actions did not help the South Sudanese people, if we admit that, are we ready to restart the way the Axis attempted, although it was a two-party arrangement?
That's Alfred Sebit, who represented the opposition group National Salvation Front, or NSF, during last week's talks in Addis Ababa. The NSF is led by General Thomas Cirillo, who formed his own faction after leaving the government in February when he vowed to overthrow President Salva Kiir. Sebit joined other opposition members like Clements Juba, who represents the South Sudan National Movement for Change. Juba says no progress will be made until a permanent ceasefire is implemented.
We believe that the first step to be undertaken is that guns must be silenced, and the silence for good, in order for our people to have hope, even us in the opposition. We cannot take the government of South Sudan serious if it continues to plan any military actions against the opposition during this period. So it is important that ceasefire is a commitment to all of us participating in this conference.
Closed-door meetings and hours of deliberations resulted in the signing of a ceasefire between armed groups on Thursday. The ceasefire went into effect at midnight, December 24th, but opposition troops in Yei accused the government of violating the agreement hours after it went into effect. In a statement to the Associated Press, presidential spokesman Atenwa Keten denied the allegations and insisted that government troops had fired in self-defense. Gabriel Changston, former Minister of Wildlife Conservation and Tourism and a representative of the Federal Democratic Party, told observers at the forum that stakeholders cannot be backed into a corner and forced to make a decision, but rather be allowed to genuinely discuss possible solutions.
We should not negotiate on conditional basis that confine us to our dug-in positions, but rather on an unconditional approach that allows us to identify, define, and isolate issues dividing us. Then we all work as a team in finding solutions to them on a win-win basis.
Henry Adwar, who leads Riek Machar's opposition group in Canada and a delegate at the talks in Addis Ababa, says Machar has had a reconciliation plan for years.
As early as 2012, Dr. Riek Machar began formulating his National Dialogue and Reconciliation Plan, even introducing it at an Initiative of Change Center event in India early that year. At the Council of Ministers Hall in Juba on the 24th November 2012, Dr. Riek Machar announced coming National Reconciliation Conference is slated to start 18 April 2013, a first ever national campaign. Unfortunately, in mid-2013, President Kiir stopped the conference and remove Dr. Riek Machar as head of the effort.
Francis Deng, South Sudan's former ambassador to the United Nations and a member of the National Dialogue Committee, reiterated President Kiir's commitment to engage all parties in a national dialogue, which he says could foster peace in the long run.
And I would say that in addition to dealing with the internal problems within communities, the end result should be revitalizing the culture of dialogue, which our people in their traditional setting used to observe very seriously. I see an intersection. Revitalization aims at ending the conflict as soon as possible. As I said, national dialogue also begins with wanting to end the conflicts. They do intersect, but we have to admit that national dialogue does not have the capacity to impose peace immediately.
The high-level revitalization forum is expected to resume early next year, although no dates have been announced. Ayan Bior for VOA News, Washington.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at people with albinism in Malawi. That story is coming up next.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
if you are a parent, what is the most important thing you have learned about raising children?
Relationship with them, close relationship is very, very important. You must always be in touch with them most of the time. Then share experiences and daily life.
I know that children learn from their beginning, so when they are very young, as a parent, we shouldn't neglect them because it is there that they pick most of their characters and their attitude.
At times, we should be considerate to kids, and we should always give them a second chance to hear what they have to say.
One major thing that I've realized about children is that you need to tell them the truth, and that helps them to build trust in you as a parent.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. In Malawi, people with albinism are expecting the new year to be free from any attacks on them, as has been in the past 5 years. About 130 albinos have so far been attacked, 15 of them this year. But as Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, the government is considering strong measures to stop the attacks.
People with albinism and absence of pigment in their skin, hair and eyes are attacked in Malawi and other parts of Africa because of false beliefs that potions made from their body parts bring good luck and wealth. In Malawi, the attacks started in 2013 despite efforts to curb the malpractices. These include abductions, murder, and grave exhumations. Overstone Kondowe is the president of Association of People with Albinism in Malawi.
On our record, we have got 130 cases, of which 25 are murder cases. 41 have been concluded, but the other cases are still being investigated.
The association says it has registered 15 cases of attacks this year alone, compared to 65 last year. It attributed the drop in the attacks due to massive campaign which government and development partners launched to end the attacks. Despite the decline, Kondowe says more needs to be done to completely end the attacks.
The first gap is that we have been unable to find the market, which is behind the continuation of this trade. We'd love a nation who really make a list of people who have names who are sponsoring or fueling this trade.
James Kadadze is the national police spokesperson. He says police investigations show that there are no markets for the albino body parts.
there are no market out there for the bonds. We have done our investigations, we have done our inquiries, we have come out to understand that it's just in the wake of crooks.
Kadazela says in the year ahead, police will continue to work with the chiefs and religious leaders to sensitize members of the general public about false beliefs that aggravate their attacks. But Kondowe says it is not true that there are no markets on Albino body parts.
You can side with me that there is no trade that can survive over 6 years, if at all people do not know exactly as to where they, you know, send body tissues. And we have been hearing about money. Who creates those figures like 6 million, something like that?
Kondowe says his association hopes the courts will continue to give stiffer penalties to those convicted in connection with the attacks. Heather Wikintab is the chairperson for the National Technical Committee on Abuse of Persons with Albinism. He told reporters this week that the government is considering to lobby for life sentences on those involved in albino attacks. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
From Blanta, we move to Kenya, where opposition lawmakers have called on the government to investigate why 90% of students scored a D plus or below on their 2017 secondary education exams. Meanwhile, the Minister of Education says he is satisfied with the results. For VOA News, Muhammad Yusuf has the story.
Speaking to reporters in Nairobi, opposition legislator Caleb Amisi says Parliament needs to know why students failed.
Kenya National Examination Council, NEC, must be ordered to prepare and present a comprehensive report over this perceived mass failure. And an independent investigation should as well be incorporated. This should be conducted by some of the most credible auditing companies in Kenya.
In 2017, more than 600,000 students sought for secondary education exams. Only 10% scored high enough to enter a university. The results have sparked an uproar among parents, teachers and others concerned about the fate of the students and the quality of Kenya's education system. A key question is what caused the high failure rate. Was it the students, the people who taught them, the curriculum, or a speed-up grading process that saw educators plow through the exams in just 3 weeks? Mark Nyamita, an opposition lawmaker, says the problem needs to be fixed or millions of young Kenyans will be barred from higher education.
If this goes on in this government over the next 5 years, we're going to have a whooping 2.5 million plus people with their future shattered.
Some officials say the mass failure resulted from efforts to reduce cheating. In an interview with Citizen Television, Education Minister Fred Matiang'i hinted that might be true, saying the result reflects the real state of Kenyan education.
I am very satisfied with the results we've had in the last 2 years, 2016 and 2017, because we have lived a lie for such a long time. Time is here for us now to deal with the truth.
Calls are growing for a national conference to resolve the crisis and decide what to do about the students who fail the exams. The issue is expected to be discussed in the National Assembly in February. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Shops in Malawi, in Mali, are full of imported goods from Europe, the Middle East and Asia. However, Mali's captains of industry maintain this is not necessary. Mali can produce a lot of what consumers at home. But for that to happen, there needs to be a wholesale revival of its industrial sector. Can it be done? Drum Postumas reports from Bamako.
This used to be a very familiar sound throughout most of Mali's territory. From Gao to Sikasso, factories produced a wide range of consumer goods. But a lot of that is gone.
On sait que l'industrie parle pas, c'est pas courant, c'est pas malien. On a une...
We are, says industry representative Cyril Ashkar, now essentially a nation of traders. There used to be industry, mostly run by the state, but 80% of that has disappeared between 1970 and 1995. Ashkar comes from a family that began developing industry in the late 1950s. He's not only one of Mali's few remaining manufacturers, he also lobbies relentlessly for its interests. Not all is gone. Some factories still work in and around the capital, Bamako, and in urban centres like Kai, Sikasso and Kulikoro. But the list of products is short. Dairy, some meat products, dried herbs and spices, one textile company, a packaging firm, the inevitable cement factory, and some hardware. No longer under the protective umbrella of the state, there is little Mali's manufacturers can do against mass-produced goods, mainly from Asia. The picture is repeated across the African continent. Can Mali's factories, the engines of an emerging economy, be brought back to life? Any decent industrial policy will have to tackle a long list of problems. They include expensive electricity, poor infrastructure, a tax regime that discourages investment and competition from mass producers like China and neighbouring countries like Senegal that can produce goods more cheaply. Where to begin? The answer? On the land. Fatoumata Haidaraba leads a government agency that helps Mali's agro-industry to become more competitive. Her agency concentrates on mangoes and maize. The mangoes are for export, and the maize produces high-quality feed for cattle and poultry. The real goal is to produce more jobs for Malians, especially the young. Cyril Ashkar thinks it can be done, but says it's a long road back to Mali's industrial recovery.
On va dire que, pour vous parler franchement, le virage, le moment pour dire que le Mali va s'industrialiser, ça n'a pas commencé.
It may help to join forces with Burkina Faso and Niger, landlocked like Mali and in similar circumstances. The markets are there, the ideas and plans are there. What's needed now is more government action to ensure that investments come in, budding industries are protected, and unfair competition is eliminated. Made in Mali, as far as the country's industry leaders are concerned, all one has to do is believe in it. Bram Postumus for VOA News, Bamako.
And that brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Giwaja by Matiang, Manasseh Matiang. Giwaja, Giwaja Shadi.
Shock up on the beat.
My family are in a foreign land, cause the war is so gruesome. I'm thinking of your security. Yeah. I never thought it would come to this. Living life so very far from thee, missing all the fond memories. Yeah. But you should know that I'm thinking of you every day. You should know that I'm missing you in every way. But you should know that I'm thinking of you every day. You should know that I'm missing you, in every way. Giwaja, Giwaja Shadi. It's so painful indeed, living that far away from my family. Giwaja Shadi, I say. Giwaja, Giwaja Shadi. It's so painful indeed, missing all these special memories. Giwaja Shadi. I've been looking at your photos in your Facebook. So much happening, I'm upset, it's so painful. But I'm thankful to God that you're growing so fast. Thankful to God that you're healthy, you're right. Hey, when I know one day we'll be okay, yeah. One day we'll be together again, yeah. I know one day we'll be together again, oh, everything will be okay. Giwaja, Giwaja Shadi. It's so painful indeed, living that far away from my family. Giwaja Shadi, I say. Giwaja, Giwaja Shadi. It's so painful indeed, missing all these special memories. Giwaja Shadi.
We have been listening to Manasseh Matiang with the song Giwaja. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Would like to hear what you think about our show. You can find us on the web at southsudan@voanews.com. You can also check us out on our Facebook site. That's South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's a painful indeed, missing all these special memories.